Okay, hello there, everyone, and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
It's Candace Lepage.
And Candace comes to us again because people may have known you and Peter were out of order, and that's because you went on a journey of your own, not to liberate the universe from... some vaguely imperialistic system, of course, but just, you know, little winter trip for yourself, as it were.
Yes, it's true. I went to Halifax, and rather than saving the universe from a vaguely imperialistic government, I actually went to the government building, and I visited the legislature while I was in Halifax, which was fun. It's like this cute little mini version of the legislature. It's so small.
End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We're here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new ensemble science fiction epic Dune Part 2, which you can now see in a theater near you, and maybe you have, given how popular Dune Part 2 seems to have been this past weekend. That's in the back half of the show, though, and we're going to have a lot of Dune thoughts, I think, but... the first half, we're going to have a lot of Oscar thoughts because they're giving out the Oscars this coming weekend. And although Dune 2 is not nominated, it might be nominated next year. But for this year, this is the trick about talking about, I think, this year's Oscars. And we're going to get into this a bit. It really seems like some aspects of this are like really well decided going into... the Oscars ceremony. It really does feel like there are certain locks, but in going through the nominees, I also found that there are maybe some lingering question marks that we can chew on. And of course, there's always the snubs and so on. Of course, the leading Oscar nominee is Oppenheimer, which has 13 nominations, among them Best Picture and Best Director. So here is my first sort of question about this year's Oscars. Can anything stop Oppenheimer from winning those top two categories, Best Picture and Best Director, for Christopher Nolan? Is it, at long last, Nolan time at the Oscars?
Has he actually not won or anything? Wow.
Nope. He's been nominated a couple times. He has never won.
Well, so he's against for Best Picture. I mean, and technically Best Picture goes to the producers, right? Not the directors or anything like that. Though, oh, I see here he is listed as one of the producers as well. So I guess he'll still get to take the stage. But
and his wife was the producer on that movie, so... like either way, an Oscar's going home with them.
yeah. I mean, I think that's the one where there is sort of a possibility. Like, I don't know, Killers of the Flower Moon. It seems like a pretty big title.
But it hasn't had any momentum, though. It seems
it hasn't really.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing. I think a lot of analysts thought it might have had a longer shelf life in the Oscars race, but it just seems like Oppenheimer has it locked.
Yeah, and like something like Poor Things, I think, has become a real sleeper hit. Like, it is very popular now, which doesn't do a lot of good for its Oscar chances, because people had to vote for it a while ago. I can't see them giving it to Barbie. I know there's all these snobs about Barbie and certain things. and I get it. Like I also think that like Greta Gerwig should have gotten a Best Director nod for that. Mm-hmm. I think more so than it being Best Picture, because it's, I don't know, even though it was my Best Picture of the year, and I think that it was kind of amazing that it even happened. I don't know. It's hard. You know, this is the thing with when you're rating movies against each other without any sort of like scale. Like, obviously, Oppenheimer is this huge, massive undertaking with like hundreds of thousands of people being employed for visual effects and for all of these things versus something like Past Lives, which is just kind of a quiet love not love story.
Yeah.
It's hard
It's
to,
funny. Yeah.
yeah.
No, it's I hear you on that. And the thing with Greta Gerwig is like I'm trying to think. I'm looking at the best director list right now. It's Justine Triet for Anatomy of a Fall, Martin Scorsese for Killers, Nolan for Oppenheimer, Yorgos Lanthimos for Poor Things, and Jonathan Glazer for The Zone of Interest. And I'm like, which one of those would I take off? The most likely one, I think, would be Scorsese. But just like in terms of like Oscar politics, and there is such a thing as Oscar politics, I don't know how you take Scorsese off the board for what many people are looking at, like the career capstone for him. But he is kind of like the sort of like the fifth out of five in terms of like who I think should win. I would love it if Jonathan Glazer wanted an upset, because like Zone of Interest is just like it's like going into a movie and like having like brain freeze, because it's so like a lot of people talk about the banality of evil, and that is it, like slathers you with the banality of evil until you leave that thing like feeling completely emotionless. And also, like, it's his fourth movie too, and I feel like we don't get enough Jonathan Glazer in our lives, so like the r rare chance to honor him. But having said that, I mean, Nolan has been he's been working in the mines for a while, so it's if this is one of those times it feels like, you know what, Nolan, he did Dunkirk, he did Inception, he did, you know, Dark Knight, and I know how you feel about those movies.
I
But
like
like
Inception.
Memento, you know, Interstellar. I mean, it just feels like he, you know, it's the earn it. It's like when Kate Winslet won for The Reader. The Reader is not her best work, but it's like we've nominated her like 300 times, so might as well just give her the Oscar and get it over with. And I feel like that's where Nolan is too. And that's not to say that Oppenheimer isn't worthy. It just feels like it's time.
I mean, I do get that. And, you know, I think Christopher Nolan is a is kind of a divisive director, mostly because you can tell that it's a Christopher Nolan film. Like, he very much puts his mark on his films, which is something I really respect. Does that, I don't know, does because I don't like Tenet, and I well don't what by don't like I say I didn't see Tenet, I didn't see Interstellar, I didn't really find any interest in seeing those films. And as you say, The Dark Knight, unfortunately, I have fallen asleep every time I've tried watching it. I am again determined. I've just been listening to a bunch of show podcasts about the Batman series, and everyone's going crazy about The Dark Knight. I'm like, oh my God, is it time to try it again? Like, obviously, I am missing something here. But yeah, I don't know. Again, I mean, it's similar to the best picture, right? Like, how do you choose what is best directing? Is it getting the best character moments, like the best out of the actor? Is it getting, you know, having the most dramatic vision on screen, which again maybe goes to something like The Zone of Interest or Poor Things? You know what it's so, I don't know. I feel like, not that I think we need more awards. I actually, I think there are enough awards. The problem is that the general public only really knows the Oscars and maybe like the Golden Globes. But meanwhile, there are so many other award ceremonies that people just don't know anything about, which might, you know, mean more to them if they knew about that award and go, oh, that makes sense for, you know, Jonathan Glazer to win that award as opposed to this Oscar, which is just like the best of the year of everything. Like, there's no way to ever decide that.
Yeah, that's maybe a conversation where, like, is a Saturn Award for like the best sci-fi film like really a lesser than award than the Oscar when you're sort of like thinking about all these things? It's interesting. But we're gonna keep pushing on with Oscar debate because that's what we're here for. So my next question here: who is the best actress? Because I think this is a two-person race. Because you have Lily Gladstone for Killers of the Flower Moon. And I think there's a lot of momentum behind her. There's also a lot of history behind her, first Indigenous person to be nominated. But there's also Emma Stone coming outside, and that goes to sort of the sleeper equality. Because I saw Poor Things end of January, and it was a Monday night, and it was like half full. And like that really, like, I was like, I went on Monday night. It's like, well, there's going to be hardly anybody else there, so I could just like sort of like. Not literally spread out, but I don't have to worry about being surrounded by other people. But it turned out I had to be worried about surrounded by other people, and I think that sort of has fed into Emma Stone coming out on the outside. But I think this is still Lily Gladstone's to lose, just because there is that sort of propulsive history behind her nomination.
Yeah, I would agree. And I mean, even though I haven't seen Killers of the Flower Moon, and I probably will here at home where I don't have to.
Or you can pause. I understand.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, everything I've heard about it is that she is absolutely the standout and really the best reason the movie was even made. You know, we talked, you and I talked a lot about the controversy over whether or not Martin Scorsese was the person to tell this story of the Osage people. But I think everybody agrees that, again, like Lily Gladstone, it's like, oh, if he was the wrong person, at least all of this came to this amazing actress who was just given this incredible role and absolutely killed it. So I would agree. Like, I can't see any of these other people winning. Like, Annette Bening is amazing, but has she won? She's won before, I think.
I can't remember off the top of my head. Let me just take a quick look here. Nomination. No, she has never won, but she this is
Lots of
her
nominations. Yeah.
fifth nomination. But
Yeah.
yeah, no,
And then
it's
Carey Mulligan, of course, is excellent, but who's actually seen Maestro? I don't know.
I have.
I'm sure you have, and I'm sure I will also, and she'll be great. But while I love Carey Mulligan, I feel like she so often plays kind of the same character, except in Promising Young Woman.
That was kind of a
So
standout,
yeah, so she's very good at what she does, but I think she's in a way sort of typecast. So.
she's very good in Maestro, but I have like stylistic issues with Maestro in that it's coded to be from her point of view, but it doesn't feel like it's from her point of view, her character. And you can consult the episode I did with Tim about Maestro a couple of weeks ago for more of that. But just yeah, like she's very, very good, but I'm not sure she raises to the level of a Lily Gladstone where it's like this is her movie.
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, it's probably the reason I'm going to watch it. It's just because I've heard so much about her and her performance and the costuming, which I don't know if costuming was on your list of things to talk about, but I absolutely think that Killers of the Flower Moon should be winning for costuming, without a doubt.
I mean, yeah, it's one of those below the line topics that we don't really get to, but I mean, Oppenheimer, it's like everybody's wearing suits. Napoleon, I mean, we've seen a Napoleonic war before. I think it's probably, I mean, Poor Things, Killers of the Flower Moon, and Barbie. I think the thing with Barbie and a lot of people are upset that Barbie didn't get more above the line, which is like those the bigger categories. But Barbie has a lot going on below the line. And if we could just sort of deviate into that just for a sec, I think Barbie's a strong contender for like production design and
Yeah,
costuming.
absolutely.
Probably song. I can't imagine the I'm Just Ken isn't gonna win. That would be
Really, you think I'm just Ken over What Was I Made For, eh? I mean, it's
Okay,
hard
fair
to
enough.
say because What Was I Made For, I think, is an incredible song. It's beautiful. It fit the movie so well, and it came up a number of times. It was almost like a motif for the film.
Okay,
And
that's fair.
was the song during the sort of the part of the movie that, to me, as I've said so many times, was so just like, how is this being done? How am I crying right now? Because the song was playing, and Margot Robbie as Barbie is, just sitting quietly looking at the world. And it's just, it was so moving. And I think a big part of that is because of the song. However, when I'm Just Ken came on, that was the moment that I said, oh, this is my best movie of the year. Then nothing's going to top this.
It's one of those weird things because sometimes I remember, was it last year Encanto was nominated, and then like nominated they didn't nominate the one everybody knew, which now I can't remember the title of it. The
Strong.
character, the weirdo, it was about
Yeah, it's
Randall.
this.
No,
No, it's the We Don't Talk About Bruno,
we don't talk
but
about
the song
Bruno.
was
Oh,
actually the
that's
one that the
right.
sister sings,
Right.
which I can't think of the name of, but is
No.
by far the best song in.
No, it's, I mean, so we can at least agree it's not the Flamin' Hot song by Diane Warren.
I mean, I do love me some Diane Warren, but I've never heard this song. And I looked it up and I was like, I don't know what movie this is.
Don't
And
remember
I don't
Flaming
know
Hot?
Flamin' Hot, but Diane Warren, I got to figure it out.
You don't remember the Flamin' Hot Cheeto movie based on a true story, but not really movie,
Oh,
directed by Eva Longoria?
I remember hearing something about it, but
Okay.
yeah, no.
Okay, good stuff. Let's move to Best Actor, and I'm calling this the Battle of the Character Actor because you have Paul Giamatti in The Holdovers. And Jeffrey Wright from American Fiction, I think, kind of like are the front runners. You also have Bradley Cooper in Maestro, Colman Domingo, sort of the dark horse for Rustin, and Cillian Murphy for Oppenheimer. I mean, Cillian Murphy's good in Oppenheimer. I'm not sure he makes that movie, he necessarily makes that movie work. Whereas I think when you look at The Holdovers in American Fiction, those are movies built around sort of the singular actors, Paul Giamatti and Jeffrey Wright. Also, guys, Jeffrey Wright never nominated for an Oscar, which is shameful. Paul Giamatti won nomination, which is a little better, also shameful. So I think this is kind of like, I think there's like a real horse race in this Oscars, at least in the above the line category. I think this is it.
I mean, I think it would be a win if either Paul Giamatti or Jeffrey Wright won. I
For
mean,
sure.
the Lord knows I love Paul Giamatti. But yeah, Jeffrey Wright, like, again, it's always nice to see a non-white actor win at the whitest show of the year. So that would be great. I mean, Bradley Cooper, I adore Bradley Cooper. In ways that I shan't talk about on the radio. But I don't know, Maestro just totally feels like Oscar bait.
Yeah.
So I nominate not him winning.
Bradley Cooper is screaming at the top of his lungs, give me an Oscar. This because it's, you know, it's this course he's been on since the Actors Studio, I think. Like he's done Broadway, he's done film, he's done prestige film, he's now directing his own movies. He's like, this man is run he's running around Beverly Hills, going from restaurant to restaurant, screaming, "Give me an Oscar!" And nobody's giving him one. And I kind of feel sorry for him, but well, not
I
really,
do,
but
but I think, I mean, I don't feel sorry for him because most of the time he's choosing big blockbuster movies, which is great. Every actor should be given the opportunity to get a, millions of dollar role in like blockbuster movies. And it is too bad that people sort of see him as, oh, the Hangover guy, or the maybe people don't see him as the A-Team guy, but I really liked him in the A-Team.
I love that A-Team movie. No, it's true. That is so overlooked. I love that A-Team movie. It's a lot of
So
fun.
people see him as kind of the action comedy, like Guardians of the Galaxy guy and don't really see his actual acting chops. I mean, the first time I ever saw him was on Felicity, which is such, not Felicity, excuse me. The other
Alias.
Alias, yeah, the other one.
Yeah.
But yeah, like he is a really good actor. He's just mostly choosing roles that are fun and will make him money. But you know, I wish he could be cast in a movie where he gets to act, where he doesn't have to make it himself and make it like this passion project like this that maybe doesn't work and maybe isn't appropriate. I don't know.
Yeah, no, maybe. All right, the supporting actor races, and I'm calling these the surprisingly boringest races because I feel like these are even kind of more locked than any of the other categories we discussed so far. So in Best Supporting Actor, we've got Sterling K. Brown for American Fiction, Robert De Niro for Killers of the Flower Moon, Robert Downey Jr. for Oppenheimer, Ryan Gosling for Barbie, and Mark Ruffalo for Poor Things. And in supporting actress, we have Emily Blunt for Oppenheimer, Danielle Brooks for The Color Purple, America Ferrera for Barbie, Jodie Foster for Naiad, and Divine Joy Randolph for The Holdovers. I gotta say, it really feels like Randolph and RDJ. And you know,
Yeah.
I will say that in the supporting actor category, you have Gosling, who is like the scene stealer in Barbie. And De Niro does like his best work in 20 years in Killers, as King Hale. But I mean, this is the completion of the Robert Downey Jr. redemption arc, is to finally get his Oscar statue. And I think, as we've sort of seen, in recent years, well, even last year too, you know, Ke Huy Quan, as you know, completing his comeback. You know, Jamie Lee Curtis, who won her Best Supporting last year, kind of cementing her status as, you know, Hollywood royalty, finally getting an Oscar there. That we kind of love this. You made it. You're now an Oscar winner. Kind of narratives, and I think that's where, I mean, and then Divine Joy Randolph, kind of like a, she's not new. She's been a very busy working actress, but you know, she's an exciting new face, and she's also very, very good in The Holdovers. Very, very important to like the key triad. Although she's kind of separate from them, and there's a whole portion of the film where she is kind of separate from the kid whose name I forget, and Paul Giamatti's character. So it's, I don't know. I usually depend on the supporting categories for like real drama, because usually that's where
Yeah.
something comes out of nowhere, and it just feels like that's not what we're getting this year.
Yeah, I mean, I have even less to say about the supporting roles because there's so many movies here I haven't really seen. Though I do hear that in Poor Things, like Mark Ruffalo's character is so unlike anything people have seen Mark Ruffalo do.
Yeah. He's
So
kind of despicable in it, which is refreshing.
yeah, it feels impossible to me for Mark Ruffalo to ever be despicable, so I'm excited to see it at some point in time because I'm just like, I don't believe they've done this, but we'll see.
Yeah, he's got like this mustache twirling villain vibe, but he's also like petulant. It's, I mean, it's nothing like, you know, Spotlight or Darkwater, where he's very righteous and in some ways self-righteous. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I do feel for The Color Purple, Danielle Brooks from The Color Purple. I think this is this their only nomination?
Above the line, I think, yes.
Yeah. It does just seem, I mean, I haven't seen it, but I think
Yeah, it's the only one. Yeah.
there's definitely a question from people about whether or not we needed a musical about this story. So it sort of feels like this is going to go down as the like, well, that was just a bad idea, wasn't it?
Yeah, I'm not sure because I haven't seen it either. I'm not necessarily against the idea, although I've never read the original book. I have, of course, seen the Spielberg version, and it doesn't, the subject matter does not easily lend itself to musical potential. It is, however, based on a Broadway musical. They adapted it for Broadway, and I think I think it's a couple of things. Number one is I'm not sh this is like one of those like secret musical things where like none of the
Yeah.
trailers really kind of point to the fact that it's a musical. And it was released like Wonka and the Color Purple were released by the same studio in the same week. So you have like two secret musicals coming out in the same week from the same studio, and you're just like, well, are you like burying this on purpose, or you know, what are you doing here? It just I think there's just generally a lot of confusion. I think it's something of a minor miracle that anything from The Color Purple rose to the surface.
Yeah. I mean it, yeah. As you say, sort of a secret musical. And there are lots of Broadway musicals that are now coming to movies and or are just very popular as Broadway musicals that I think a lot of people want to see, but nobody really, it hasn't been sold that way at all. You know, as opposed to
Mean Girls too.
exactly. Yeah, Mean Girls was, you know, sort of more clearly, oh, this is the musical version. I mean, they could have done as High School Musical did, High School Musical, the movie, the musical. And then, you know, bring it back. You just gotta put musical in there somewhere.
Can we pour one out for your boy Charles Melton too? Because he wasn't nominated at all for Best Supporting Actor, and I think he was probably the best part of May December.
I see. May December didn't really come out with much either, did it?
No, I don't think. I think it got the screenplay, and I think that was it. Best original screenplay. And I think that's because it was kind of like a light year for original screenplays.
Yeah.
But I've heard some commentary that's like it's punishing just how kind of critical it is about the actor, the process of doing research as an actor, which I kind of get. It
Yeah.
does kind of feel like a dig. Natalie Portman playing this kind of self-centered actress who goes in and starts throwing bombs because she's doing research, and one of them is kind of at Charles Melton, who is the story, of course, is based on very loosely on Mary Kay Letourneau and the relationship she had with a student. But yeah, it feels like a huge miss to like to not have Charles Melton in the mix, because
Yeah.
I think he did make that movie in a lot of ways, and just he was very, very grounded, very, very real, which I really appreciated, because I think both Natalie Portman and Julianne Moore were kind of responsible for like really the heightened drama of that a lot of people found distasteful, but Charles Melton really brings it down, which I appreciated.
Yeah, and come on, can we just not give any of the kids from Riverdale an Oscar? Let's
It's true. It feels like they just kind of like disappeared into the ether. Like
Yeah, I
that.
mean Cole Sprouse is just all over the sort of like online only like Netflix and Amazon movies.
I think Camila Mendes had like a Amazon movie a couple of weeks
She
ago.
did. Well, her Due Revenge also was great. But yeah, I think you're right. I think there was a more sort of adult kind of rom-com, hate rom-com sort of thing. I don't remember what it was called, but
And then Betty, what's her face?
Lily Reinhardt.
Yes, she was in I'm just blanking on names today. She was in the Scafaria movie about the adult entertainers who ripped bankers off. I can't remember the name of it.
Hustlers.
Hustler, that's
Yeah, I
right,
just
with
have her
J-Lo,
film.
and yeah, she was, yeah, that was a good movie. Kiki Palmer
Yeah.
was in that too. Yeah.
Lily Reinhardt, I think, you know, having been a huge fan of Riverdale, I would say Lily Reinhardt was like the sort of outstanding actress on that show. So, you know, I would like to see her do more. I mean, it's great to see Camila Mendes doing things, because she's just fun, and it's always easy, I think, to it's not easy to play sort of the villainous teen girl, but it's easy for people to see that person playing the villainous teen girl and say, oh, I can do something with that.
Are you saying it's more fun to be Veronica than it is being Betty?
Well, you know, I don't know. I don't know. Both of them have terrible parenting on Riverdale, so
Well,
I'd
touche.
rather be the redhead, who's also very has some issues.
Yeah,
Kids,
I
if you want
I
some great soap opera, watch Riverdale.
I think I took a powder on Riverdale after season one, but that's okay. That's a discussion for another time. We are going to take a break here and then come back for Dune Part 2. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. You can blow with this, or you can blow with that, or you can blow with us. You can blow with this, or you can blow with that. You can blow with this, or you can blow with that, or you can blow with that. Walk without rhythm, it won't attract the worm. Walk without rhythm, and it won't attract the worm. Walk without rhythm, and it won't attract the worm. If you walk without
rhythm. Here.
Thanks.
Don't try to impress anyone. You're brave, we all know that. Be simple, be direct. Nothing fancy.
Nothing fancy.
Hey, I'm serious. Nothing fancy or you will shame my teaching.
I won't shame you. I understand.
Shai Hulu decides today if you become Fremen or if you die.
Okay, that was a clip from Dune Part 2. It is the new film from Denis Villeneuve, and it stars Timothée Chalamet, Zendaya, Rebecca Ferguson, Josh Brolin, Austin Butler, Florence Pugh, Dave Bautista, Christopher Walken, Stellan Skarsgård, Charlotte Rampling, and Javier Bardem. This is the continuation of Dune, which came out in 2021. A lot of people were upset that they got half a movie. I don't feel like I got half a movie with Dune Part 1. Maybe I'm a weirdo, but I feel like it sort of ends with this sort of like perfect kind of like hopeful kind of, we've got a plan note, and if we didn't get a Dune Part 2, I might have been okay. But I'm glad we did get Dune Part 2. I actually saw it in IMAX, which was an experience and a half.
I bet.
So it's... That was awesome, with a packed audience Friday at Scotiabank Theater in Toronto. Almost every seat was full. So, you know, this is a ride I think people have been waiting for. And I'm not sure if it's because Dune has sort of festered in appreciation since it came out in 2021, or if it's just because there hasn't been a lot going on in the movies in a couple of months.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's based on the first film, and well, not only the first film, but also the cast, which is
right.
Just like intensely stacked.
Yeah, that's kind of what struck me halfway through. It's like, this is like the young Hollywood buffet, because you get Chalamet, you get Zendaya, you get Pugh, you get Butler. This is like their coming out party, or their, I guess maybe their cotillion. It's like, now we are Hollywood kind of deal. It feels, and I'm not sure, I doubt that was Villeneuve's intent, but there is a real alchemy to this movie outside of just, you know, what Villeneuve wants to do and what the intent of the movie is. It just feels like it's seminal in that sort of generational divide that you get these four. I guess you could argue Zendaya, Chalamet, Pugh, Butler. I mean, we're stars before this, but like, there's a real solidification of their status with this. They are the new Hollywood.
Yeah, yeah. It's the passing of the torch, as they say.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Well, let's get into some general thoughts, and we'll try to keep spoilers to a minimum. I do want to kind of get into spoilers at some point, but just sort of like general thoughts. How do you feel coming out of Dune Part 2?
Well, as everybody knows, I reject a movie that's over like 2 hours and 5 minutes, which this was considerably. It was 2 hours and 46 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Didn't feel like it, though.
No, I would agree. It didn't feel like it. And the first movie was like 2 hours and 20, I think, which is sort of funny to think. When I sort of, because before going, I went, let me look back at like what I thought about the first one. Which was, wow, it's a 2 hour and 21 minute like introduction to an actual story. And I'm like, oh, it only took them 20 extra minutes to tell the actual story part. That's interesting. But yeah, so I always hesitate with a long movie, but I also understand the immensity of this story and that it needs a lot of time. And I think it was fine for length. Like it was actually, I don't think it was it didn't feel too long to me. It is a lot of time to commit, but it did not feel too long. Though I did have to laugh out loud at one point where Zendaya's, excuse me, Zendaya's character Chani says to Paul, "The story's not over yet, is it?" Like, really? You're just gonna drop that line in? We're at least 20 or 30 minutes from the end of the runtime. We're just gonna just slight nod to those in the in the audience watching at home. But essentially, I would say within about 5 minutes of this movie starting, actually probably less than that, maybe 2 minutes, I was like, oh yeah, I loved the score from the first Dune, and why have I not been listening to that every damn day since it came out? Like, I forgot how good the score is. And I know Hans Zimmer is sort of overrated, and everything he does kind of sounds like Hans Zimmer. But I guess I just really like that sound because the score, like, it starts right away, and you're like, oh yes, here we are back in this world. This is it. At no point does this not feel like a real place, and nothing about it sticks out as out of place. Like, everything is just perfectly, yeah, perfectly placed, perfectly acted. Everything feels real about this whole story, which is such a testament because it is a pretty futuristic, different sort of thing, especially in this one as they start to introduce the Emperor and more of the sort of intrigue with the different houses.
Yeah, I to get the Hans Zimmer of it out of the way, I like his work here. There are moments where it feels like, because there are moments where Villeneuve doesn't use a score to sort of punctuate the drama. I mean, one of the big ones is when Paul rides the Shai-Hulud, the sandworm, for the first time. You don't hear the score until he like stands up on the, and I'm not spoiling it because they released the whole scene on YouTube.
We all know he's gonna do it.
And we all know he's going to do it. It's part of the hero's journey, but you know, he's riding the sandworm, and but all through that is he's trying to like get the hooks and the stuff and doing the jumping. It's without the score. There's also a scene, a fairly climactic, dramatic scene near the end where there's no score. And I feel like there are moments where Hans Zimmer's like, Denis, like you didn't let me score these moments, so like I'm gonna like just overdo it in these other portions of the
Yeah.
film. I'm just gonna hammer it, I'm gonna hammer it. But that's okay. You know, Hans Zimmer is a total pro, and I don't think I've ever like really hated anything he's ever done music wise. I think he's kind of that guy. But yeah, what I found interesting is like you what Villeneuve does, and I can see why people who are kind of like more TV centric, like kind of raised on the era of PTV, might have issue with this, is that you kind of get these scenes that are not completed scenes where we get set up, we get execution, we get the follow through and the end of the scene. A lot of these scenes are very sort of like we're in the middle of something, and then we cut away and then we cut back again, and who knows how much time has passed. You know, Paul kind of goes from there, he's in with the Fremen, they're suspicious of him, to like, okay, now you're going to go out in the desert and prove yourself, and then we're off to like the last test, which is him riding the sandworm, and all of that's kind of like in the first hour. So there's this very sort of propulsive motion to it that it's like kind of daring you to keep up, and I guess that's because there's just so much story to get through. But I mean, I was there for it. Like I never felt lost, and I think we're all kind of acquainted with the hero's journey to understand, like you go from the neophyte to the master, and then you go out and do the mission. Because I mean, the point of this, we're getting into some slight territory, spoiler territory here, but like the point of the Dune story, and Villeneuve is very making this pointedly, it's like, yes, it's a hero's journey, but it's not the hero's journey you're comfortable with. Like a lot of Dune is borrowed by stuff like Star Wars and Harry Potter, except the key part, which is the hero's journey is not what you think it is. And it's made, there's maybe something a bit wrong with depending on the one guy to come and save you from everything.
I'm glad to hear you say that. And, I've sort of heard similar from other people. Now, I have read the book, just the first one, none of the, like, whatever, 14 other novels after. Obviously, have seen the David Lynch movie. That was
Frank
very,
Herbert's family's got to eat, you know.
but the Lynch movie, of course, very formative in my childhood. So I do know the story a little bit. But yeah, I found, I would say the first, half, maybe two-thirds of this movie were very much like hero's journey. It's following the same thing. And then the last third or so, I started to just get depressed and just like, wow, this says a lot about humanity and the moment that we're in right now, right? Where our, like, everything, every choice that Paul makes, he's trying to not do the thing he's destined to do, which, as we know, the destiny may or may not be true. But every choice he's pushing, he's actively pushing against that. And I think because he actually knows that a hero's journey like that doesn't actually end in, and then they lived happily ever after. Because once any person reaches a certain amount of power, I don't know what it is about humanity, but someone always has to challenge it. There's never an end. There's just, and I just felt so, I mean, pleasantly depressed because the movie was great. I loved what it was saying, but I was like, holy, I feel like I'm going to be such a downer for the rest of the weekend because every single thing, nothing is going to bring us like peace and togetherness. Always. Always is going to come back to, then we have to fight the next person. Even though, the Fremen had a sort of righteous fight against the Emperor and the Harkonnens and then the Atreides as well when they were there. There's no, the only outcome there is more fighting. Even after you've won, it's more fighting. Like, oh my gosh, this is so, I don't know if it's just because of the times we're in right now, but that felt so blatant on screen to me.
There's so much about it, like the human nature, like the whole thing about how Paul is the chosen one, and you get the character Stalib, I think his name is
Stilgar?
Stilgar, thank you. The Javier Bardem character, and Javier Bardem is so great. He's so funny in this too, which is something I wasn't expecting. But there are so many times where Paul's early in the film, he's like, I'm not a chosen one, I'm not a messiah, I'm not a prophet. And then it cuts to Stilgar. He's like, you see, he's too humble to identify himself. There's clearly a message like you can rectify anything, is if you believe hard enough.
I mean,
And
which is said right in the film, right? Like, there
That's true.
is the story about like the fundamentalists in the South and the there's so much. It's very easy to watch this movie. It's just like a sort of a fun action movie with a bit of a hero's journey, but there's just so much in there, which is obviously why it went on for 14 more books.
And there's so much, like the whole thing with the Bene Gesserit, and they're like moving the various families and hooking up different families to mix the bloodlines and get like the right genetic combination to bring forth this messiah figure. It may be Paul, it may not be Paul, and there's this terrific exchange near the end between Jessica, Paul's mother, and the Reverend Mother, played by Charlotte Rampling. And, you know, Jessica says to her telepathically, "You picked the wrong side." And Charlotte Rampling says, "There are no sides," which is just such like the ultimate sort of nihilism. You've been watching this movie for almost 3 hours, and it's like, there's a good side and there's a bad side. It's like, well, is there?
Yeah, I will say, sort of, to Denis Villeneuve's credit, he did make some changes to the film, and primarily a huge one was changing Zendaya's character, Chani, into a stronger figure, a bigger figure, and to give her sort of our, like, as the audience, our point of view of, like, is this really, like, what is supposed to be happening here? Like, I don't think this is the right choice. And I think it's good because it never really struck me before how incredibly misogynist it is, the whole Bene Gesserit. Like, as a child, I saw it, and all I saw were these, like, powerful witches, right? Who have power and are doing things. And even, like, there is something to see there, but in this film, I'm like, oh, I think Frank Herbert really thinks that women are all, like, conspiring against everybody.
Yeah.
And that because they can't actually hold the power, it's men who have the power. They have to do all this back of house conspiring so that they have something. I'm like, I can see that so clearly, that this man from the 50s thinks that all women are shrews, basically.
Well, I mean, it sort of turns it on its head now that, you know, Herbert's coming at it from a very 1950s point of view, and the you know, the coming of the sexual revolution. And now there's kind of like this trend amongst some people, powerful figures, at least in the political right, who, you know, want to go back to that. So there is kind of I think there's kind of an acknowledgement in maybe the subtext that the Bene Gesserit could be a sort of a response to going back to, you know, women being forced back to of older times, as it were. And this is the way they get power. This is the way they control things. So that could be one reading of it as well, from the Villeneuve perspective or adaptation.
Yeah. Not that we're saying Villeneuve thinks that, but
no. I think that's kind of the way he's, because I did clock that. I haven't read the book, but I did clock the changes to Johnny, especially where sort of she ends in the film, again, not to spoil things, but there's a very, even just sort of like reading the Wikipedia plot synopsis for the Dune novel and the next book in the series, Dune Messiah, there's very clearly a demarcation in terms of how the character is made and how the character is established. Villeneuve giving a very sort of modern reading to the Johnny character, and not making her just the, oh, Paul, you're the greatest, or whatever is going on.
And you know what? Zendaya played her so well. I was concerned a little bit in the first movie and when she was announced as doing this role. Because I thought, oh, is she just going to be like arm candy? Because she's a beautiful woman. But she isn't at all. She's very much her own character. She is very powerful. Yeah. I think it's quite well done. And on top of that, I think it's interesting, sort of the love story between Paul and Chani, as played by Timothy Chalamet and Zendaya, because I don't know. I'm like, I feel like we didn't actually get that much of it on screen, or it felt sort of sped up, again, probably because there was so much to tell, but it kind of felt like suddenly they were just together.
Yeah.
But I still found it believable, even though we didn't really see that happening. And what I also liked about that is that Chani's character continued to push him afterwards. Mm-hmm. Like when he first came in at the end of the first Dune, when he first joined the Fremen.
Yeah, she's unimpressed.
She was making fun of him, just calling him a white boy, basically. You can't do this. And that doesn't really stop. Like, even after they do become a couple and they're, you know, significant partners.
Yeah.
She still pushes him and she still doesn't let go of the fact that he is not a Fremen. He's not them and he can't really ever be.
Yeah.
But I think that there's something about the way the two of them acted it that just made it feel really natural, even though it's not like I want to say that they don't have chemistry, because they do, but there just wasn't like a, I don't know. There's something, it felt a little bit, maybe because I just watched so many Hallmark movies. So it felt like there were some steps that were missing.
Sure.
From the beginning to them becoming a couple. But then once they were a couple, it was very natural.
Yeah, I think it's lacking that sort of star-crossed quality that a lot of these relationships in these sorts of movies have. There's always like the dutiful girlfriend, and no matter how strong she is, she's always kind of secondary. And I think that it's sort of built into the relationship that in the world where he is sort of like the Messiah, or even just like the Duke of Arrakis, she's like the wife or the partner, where she kind of has like a secondary role. And Shani lives a life where she doesn't have a secondary role. She is herself. She doesn't need that relationship if it's not serving her and if it's not someone who's equal to her. And I think I got that impression all through the film, is that she is sort of like the one person who, or at least the one person who doesn't need Paul to serve a function other than like we're equals, we're romantic partners. And you know, but I'm not going to be like the person bowing to you, and I'm not going to be like the person who, you know, is okay with you, you know, having a political marriage to the princess or whatever. It's, you know, it's like we're either in this together or we're not in this. And I think that's very subtly telegraphed through the film. I didn't need their relationship to be like overly cloying or sweet. I think you get exactly what you need out of it.
Yeah. Because I know the story, I did wonder, as you know, the first sort of part where he's out in the desert with them learning, trying to like integrate with the Fremen. I was surprised that there was no time jump, that this was it began and ended in a fairly linear timeline, with his mother still pregnant and his sister not born. Which I was like, whoa, this is, I mean, I think it's fine, obviously. And it did mean changing some things towards the end about who kills who and how the Atreides take back the, you know, Arrakis. And I think it's like, I think it was definitely the right choice. When I talk about how so much of this movie is really weird, so much of the story is really weird, we haven't really talked about his mother and how she's pregnant.
Yeah.
And there are literal scenes where Paul and his mother are both speaking to the unborn sister.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, that stuff, like, I think it was really well done.
Yeah.
And I think it, for those of us who know who his sister is and what she's capable of, it's kind of like, okay, this is great. They're doing a really good job. But for people who don't really know, I think it actually makes it a little more palatable. I think they definitely would have, having a weirdo sister child in the movie would have maybe been, made it a little harder for some people to follow along, to get on board with this.
Yeah. Well, the
I think it was the right choice.
And the casting for it was really perfect. And I wish it hadn't been spoiled, because as soon as Anyway, I'll leave that
yeah,
there.
Yeah, I hadn't seen, like, I didn't know any of the casting going in, except that I knew Austin Butler and Florence Pugh. Those were the only two that I knew
Yeah,
had been sort of added.
it was spoiled online a couple of weeks ago.
Oh my
Who,
gosh.
yeah, it was, yeah, kind of brutal. All right. And it's also kind of brutal that we're in at the end of the show, but we get there every week just the same. So that is a wrap, and we hope you liked it. If you want to listen to our show again, you can download it every Friday from our website, endcreditsradioshow.com, from the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or through your favorite app like Apple, Google, TuneIn, and Spotify. We're also on Spotify with the playlist for much of the music that you hear on End Credits. Just open up Spotify and search for End Credits on CFRU. You can stay connected to us on social media. We're on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show and Twitter at End Credits Radio. I'll be back here on CFRU tomorrow at 5 p.m. for news and politics on Open Source's Guelph with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, I'm also on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can check out my news and politics site at guelphpolitico.ca. And Candace, where can people find you on the internet?
Yes, you can find me everywhere on the internet at Sin48, that's CINN48, Blue Sky, Mastodon, Spoutable, Threads, Reddit, Letterboxd, all the places that aren't the one we shall not name.
All right. Speaking of stuff to name, CFRU, stay tuned for more great programming here on this network, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We shall return, of course, next Wednesday at 3 p.m. for another edition of End Credits, and we will see you then.